Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman who has chronicled that war in several important phases, including, quite regularly, our own, is Diana West. She is a longtime syndicated columnist. She blogs these days at dianawest.net. She is the author of two must-read books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. And she has recently posted a very important piece that kind of synthesizes information from several others as well about Robert Mueller, best known these days for his role as special counsel pursuing this Will of the Wisp, as best I can tell, a charge that somehow Donald Trump or his campaign colluded with the Russians. In the absence of any evidence, they're pursuing a lot of other Wills of the Wisp. But for the moment, Diana is calling our attention to what Robert Mueller's previous incarnation, notably that of the director of the FBI, did to our understanding of this war for the free world, and I would argue to our ability to wage it effectively. Diana West, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us, as well as for this important piece about Mueller's FBI, as you call it. Tell us a little bit about, specifically, about what he did as the FBI director in this part of the battle space.
I would love to, because I think it's something that we tend to forget with the flood of information that overwhelms us daily. I was looking back at his tenure and trying to construct a chronology. And of course, he became director of the FBI 1 week prior to 9/11. So we have him coming in and then, of course, dealing with the horrible aftermath. And what we see is a pattern that is just confirmed and reconfirmed throughout the next decade plus as director. And this is an effort not to understand, not to take the most important measures to understand jihad, to prosecute jihad, and take care of the country, make national security first. But we see him acting to suppress, also to cover up key aspects of both the jihad and the Saudi cells that were responsible for the attack of 9/11, specifically his efforts to deflect from investigators interested in pursuing leads in San Diego, where an important Saudi cell was set up. And then years later, we find out another Saudi cell in Sarasota, Florida, was also effectively blacked out by Director Mueller and his FBI at the time. We find other black marks here, which would be a very curious aversion to hiring the Arabic translators who signed up in New York City after essentially being solicited by the New York City office of the FBI. Something close to 100 applicants came on board to try to help with this incredible overload of Arabic translation work that the FBI was facing after 9/11, none of them was hired. And here's where we might want to connect to the other vector of Mueller's FBI tenure, which is Muslim outreach. This becomes the biggest blindfold on understanding Islamic jihad and all the rest of it that our country was essentially paralyzed by, because essentially Israeli translators would be an offensive thing to Arabic translators. And here we start with an incredible effort to cleanse, eradicate, neutralize FBI analysis of the jihad that actually came down to lexicons that eliminated the actual language you need to even have any understanding that Islam is part of the jihad, literally.
Or that jihad is part of the terrorism. I mean, it's unbelievable. And do drill down on this a bit, if you would, Diana West, because this business of the lexicon, as our friend and colleague Stephen Coughlin has pointed out, was so dramatic. Just a few years before, the 9/11 Commission had used a whole slew of words to describe accurately what we were dealing with. And what happened on Bob Mueller's watch with the FBI's official lexicon?
Right. Well, this would be in the 9/11 Commission report. We still saw words like Islam, Muslim, Jihad, Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, Sharia. All of this disappears in the lexicon that came out in 2008 at the end of the Bush administration. It's important to note this is not just an Obama creation. This was the end of the Bush administration. So, of course, we can look forward to the terrible jihad attack at Fort Hood by Major Hassan and understand that FBI analysis at this point is completely paralyzed in terms of predicting to understand what Major Hassan was doing in his preparation for his act of jihad in 2009. We see this later, another terrible failure that goes right back to the elimination of the words to understand jihad and terrorism and all the rest of it, when we see the Boston Marathon attack in 2013. Previous to that, in 2012, we had seen a very dramatic purge of whatever remaining training information was left in terms of jihad training, trainers who understood, jihad realists and so on, who were still training law enforcement, and this was also being done in the military as well. But Mueller was directly involved in the purge of these kinds of Islamic training materials that took place in 2012. And then, of course, in 2013, how do we not connect that failure, that neutralization, that complete willful blindness, to borrow Andy McCarthy's phrase, on Islamic jihad, that then lends itself to another atrocity in Boston.
And actually, Andy, I think, has amended his description of this as a compulsory blindness, in fact. The risk of job action against FBI agents who actually have tried to understand what we're up against and what needs to be done to counter it. One of them being our friend John Guandolo, who essentially was driven out of the bureau because, in the end, he was insisting on talking about the unmentionable, the nature of this totalitarian ideology and its determination to destroy us from within, as the Muslim Brotherhood has described it. I did want to also just invite you to say a word quickly, Diana West, about Bob Mueller's similar kind of peculiar conduct with respect to certain Russian-related activities. In fact, specifically, would you just say a word about this ghost stories business?
Yes, well, Ghost Stories was a decade-long FBI counterintelligence operation that was targeting deep-cover Russian agents who were living here as Americans. They were living here undercover, and they were trying to get into the elite power circles, in this case of the Democratic Party in New York. One was getting very close to Hillary Clinton. This was 2010, the time of the Russian reset, the Uranium One deal, all of these things going on, and Robert Mueller's FBI rolled up that investigation at this very critical juncture, rushed all of these agents home back to Russia before there could be any adequate debriefing. And I think in this case, we see another side of Robert Mueller's tenure, which is serving political masters over national security.
Diana West, thank you as always for the great work you do. Check out her writings, often at the Daily Caller, but always at dianawest.net. And next up, Senator Jim Inhofe joins us, the acting chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. We'll talk about the condition of our military, hypersonics, and the nomination of Mike Pompeo. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a delight to say we are joined by one of the most important legislators, for my money, in the United States Senate. He is these days acting as the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. He's long served as a senior member of it. The chairman, of course, Senator John McCain, is now recovering from various ailments. And in his stead, the senator from Oklahoma, senior senator from Oklahoma, Senator Jim Inhofe, is minding the store, and very, very impressively so. Senator Inhofe is also a senior member of the Environment and Public Works Committee. He is a patriot of the first order, and I'm very proud to say a former recipient of the Center for Security Policy's Keeper of the Flame Award, which he has deserved many times over. Senator Inhofe, welcome back. It's so good to have you, sir.
Well, it's nice to be with you, Frank. It sure is. And, you know, one of the jobs that I've taken on is to try to explain to the American people what happened to our military during the 8 years of Obama. And I don't say this in a critical way of him, because quite frankly, he was a very proud liberal, and it's the hypocrites that I don't like, the ones who press release conservative and vote liberal. But anyway, what has happened to us in so many areas that you know, and I know you talk about this, we are inferior. Our artillery, we can fire 4 rounds a minute. China and Russia can fire between 8 and 10 rounds a minute, just to let them know that we don't have the what we should be having. Our nuclear modernization program just stopped, but it didn't stop overseas. So I think this new policy that the president has, where the 2-3 policy, where he takes those areas where we're being advanced, and it was Dunford that made the statement. He said, this is 2 years ago, he said that we are rapidly getting to the point where we have lost our competitive, our qualitative and quantitative edge. So we've got some serious problems, and I understand that you've got an idea on hypersonic, and people don't normally know what that is. But anytime you have something that can go 5 times the speed of sound, you got to pay attention to it.
Well, you know, I was struck by a testimony before your committee, I believe it was last week, the man that the president has nominated to become the new commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific, Admiral Philip Davidson, was very categorical about the problem that he's seeing in that theater in terms of our ability to hold our own in a conflict should it come with the Chinese. And hypersonics was, of course, one of the areas that he was very concerned about. Tell us a little bit about the phenomenon of hypersonic missile technology and why we should be so concerned about it.
Well, why we should be is because we were not reacting to a new technology that has the capability of firing at 5 times the speed of sound. In fact, just the other day, Russia claimed that they had something that would go 10 times the speed of sound. The point is, both China and Russia are into the advanced technology, and we're just talking about it. We haven't done anything there. They've jumped out ahead of us, and it's a very serious thing because this is the very latest in new technology, something that we're going to have to be on top of, and we're not.
And, of course, this is designed to defeat our missile defenses, which you have been a champion of, as have I. And it's a message to us all that they're working so hard to do it. You know, Senator, you've been as critical as anybody, I think, of Hillary Clinton over the years. One of the things that I find just absolutely scandalous about this hypersonic business, as I'm sure you know, is that that was among the technologies that was transferred by Hillary Clinton's State Department under the Obama administration to the Russians as part of this so-called Skolkovo reset with the Russians. And it's just insanity that it was done, but now these things are being pointed at us to our extreme peril.
I've got to tell you this, though, because I haven't talked to you since I was in the South China Sea, and there's something going on over there, and this will sound a little bit hysterical, I know, but these islands you hear about, they talk about reclaiming islands. Well, they're not reclaiming them, they're creating them, because there's nothing, no land there to start with. They're up over 3,000 acres now, and what they're doing, it's almost as if they're preparing for World War III. So our allies that we've traditionally had, the Philippines, Taiwan, South Korea, Tokyo, they're all now actually looking to see if World War III is coming, whose side are they going to be on? Because all they see is this surge of power by China. And I thought it was interesting, you mentioned Davidson. He didn't have the background, actually, that Harris has had there. But nonetheless, he sees China in a broader perspective, because what's happening in the South China Sea is the same thing that's happening all over the world. I mean, look at Djibouti. It's the first time China's ever had a foreign base.
Well, in a couple of millennia, I suspect, at least. But this is the point, Senator, and I really want to salute you for the leadership you've exhibited over the years, many years in the Senate and before that in the House, on the importance, the strategic importance of Africa. And you've got the Chinese in Djibouti. I gather you've got the Russians moving in there. The Iranians and others are all focusing now increasingly on Africa as a cockpit for access to resources and strategic positions. It's extraordinarily important that we're paying attention to this. And I just wanted to say to your question about the hypersonics, Senator, one of the things that I believe could be a game changer for the United States is a predictive algorithm that allows, conceivably, even our existing fairly rudimentary missile defense systems to go to where the puck is going to be, as Wayne Gretzky used to say, not to try to find it, you know, and chase it where it isn't. This is the sort of thing that we've got to be doing if we're going to have a shot, literally, physically, a shot at these hypersonic threats as they're emerging. And I commend you for your leadership in this space. I would love to work with you on seeing what we could do to get this brought to bear.
Well, Frank, you're right on that, but let's keep in mind, we need to catch up first. I mean, not first. Maybe that's a backup, the only thing we have right now. But they are light years ahead of us right now. When I say light, actually 2 years ahead of us. And this is in a technology. But if you look at a nuclear modernization program, they all have triads, but China and Russia. So while we've been sliding for those 8 years, they were very aggressive. But I like this 2-3 program that the president has, and that says you take the ones that are actually our peers, that's China and Russia, and then don't forget about the threats that are out there with Iran and ISIS and so forth.
Senator, one thing that I just would ask you to say, it does seem to me you were very gentle with Obama, noting that he was an out-and-out liberal. But I think it is really accurate to describe what he did as a wrecking operation against the United States military. And despite your best efforts and others on the Armed Services Committee in the Senate and the Congress more generally, we're really behind the power curve on so much of this stuff. And if I may, it seems to me this is a moment when we need the sort of leadership that President Trump is now bringing to bear, both in his own right, of course, but also by his appointment of John Bolton to the National Security Council. And I did want to ask you about Mike Pompeo. You'll be voting shortly for his confirmation to be the next Secretary of State. Some of your colleagues have really thrown everything conceivable at him, I think, without grounding or foundation. But your thoughts on this nomination and his prospects?
There's no one in America that would be, in my opinion, as good as Mike Pompeo. Look at his background. He's always been a hawk. He wants to decertify the Iran deal. He's already met with Kim Jong-un. He was graduated at the top of his class at West Point. And now you have, it's interesting, this sounds a little bit partisan here, but the Democrats that are coming across and supporting some people like Pompeo, they're the ones that are the endangered species.
<That's> exactly
they're the ones,
right.
It's kind of funny when you get in cycle and you're a Democrat, all of a sudden you vote like a Republican.
It concentrates your mind, as they say.
Yep, that's right. So I think I'm going to be with Pompeo today, and I'll tell him we talked about him and the compliments that are there. Between him and John Bolton, I can't think of two people that I feel more secure with than those two.
No, well, I think the president should feel that way as well. Let me ask you, Senator, I would be really remiss if I didn't touch base with you on one other of your very important priorities in the United States Senate. I mentioned you're a member of the Environment and Public Works Committee. You were its chairman for quite some time. The president, of course, is feting his French counterpart this week, one of whose passions, of course, is to get the United States back into the Paris Climate Change Accord. He also wants him to stay in the Iran deal, and that's a crazy bit of business, it seems to me. But just on climate change, Senator, you've been perhaps the single most vigorous critic of this whole premise that we're facing now an apocalyptic situation as a result of greenhouse gases that men are responsible for. Talk us through that very quickly, if you would, sir, where things stand.
Yeah, I think people have to understand, it's not a matter of climate change. They changed that because they lost the global warming war. And everyone agrees climates always change. All biblical, all the evidence is out there, and we all realize it does. But the thing that they contend is global warming is coming. It's due to man-made anthropogenic gases, and it's going to be the end of the world. Now, I'll tell you something kind of interesting. I didn't realize this till I got it. The book that I wrote about this, it's called The Greatest Hoax. It's starting to resell now. And what it does, but when you talk about the Paris deal, keep in mind, Frank, many of the people who are listening to us now don't realize that it's all the United Nations. They're the ones that have this big party every December, spending our money as well as others, and to try to convince the 192 countries that the world's coming to an end and they have to ration all their stuff. And I'm pretty active in Africa, and I won't mention which country it is because I don't want to embarrass him. But one of the individuals I went up to and I said, "What are you doing joining this thing?" And he said, "Well, this is where all the money is."
Senator Jim Inhofe, thank you for your service to our country, both in uniform a long time ago and that you've been rendering as a public servant in your state of Oklahoma and, of course, in the United States Congress. Now in the United States Senate, where I am delighted you are acting chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, my alma mater. It's so good to talk with you, sir. We'll do it again soon. God bless you.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by one of the most impressive legislators in the House of Representatives, by my lights. He is the Honorable Scott Perry. He represents with great distinction the people of the 4th District of Pennsylvania. He is, among other things, a Brigadier General in the United States Army Reserves. He has seen combat, including in cockpits of various fixed-wing and rotary aircraft. He is a man who knows his way around the kinetic kind of war, as well as the political kind. He serves on the House Homeland Security Committee, serving, among other things, there as the chairman of its oversight subcommittee. He is also a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He is always a welcome guest here. Congressman, thank you so much for coming back. Good to talk with you, sir.
Frank, great to be here. Thanks for this wonderful opportunity, as always.
Well, the opportunity is always available to you, sir. We would like to talk with you about a problem that I know you've given a lot of thought to over the years. It happened to have gotten some very, very important coverage by Mark Levin on Sunday night. I know you didn't have a chance to see it, but he had a full hour of conversation with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, one of our colleagues in our Secure the Grid Coalition, one of the real leaders in the country on the vulnerability of this most critical of critical infrastructure. I know in your capacity as the chairman of the Oversight Subcommittee, Congressman Perry, you've been thinking hard about various vulnerabilities of our country's homeland. I'm hard-pressed to think of one that's more acute than this. How serious would you say the problem is, especially with evidence, among other things, that the Russians are now cyber penetrating our grid's electronic infrastructure?
Right. Well, it is a big deal and a big concern. And of course, I don't want to say that the advent of Russian incursion into our electricity grid is something that, you know, is new and should concern us. It should concern us, but it's not new. Maybe everybody's awareness from Mark Levin's show and Dr. Pry makes it new, but that doesn't mean it's not something, a target that the Russians have long sought after. And just remember this as well, Frank, they have a history of not only being interested in the electricity grid of various countries, they have a history of actually taking action. And this isn't just a matter of shutting the lights off for 10 or 20 minutes or something like that. This is of a huge magnitude where literally great swaths of the electricity grid can be turned off for an extended period of time, and just picture yourself in your home. You know, we go without power for half an hour, and you start thinking about the food in your freezer, and you can't flush the toilet or get a drink of water, et cetera. I mean, Americans are just not accustomed to that. And if you live in one of the inner cities, you know, where life is really absolutely completely dependent upon power, this is a critical vulnerability that the United States has. And the fact that Russia in particular has taken a I don't think it's anything new that they've taken an interest in. And what's new is the more of us are aware of their interest. That is greatly concerning. And of course, on our committee, on my committee, and on the whole committee, the Homeland Security Committee, this has been a concern of many of the members, the vulnerability of the electricity grid and what we're doing / not doing to protect it and to safeguard it.
I pray that this will all translate into some urgent corrective action, Congressman. I think the Trump administration's been talking a lot about improving our infrastructure. This is right at the top of the list, it seems to me, to protect the grid. Let me turn to another important topic with you, Congressman. You are, as I mentioned, a member who has served in uniform. You still have the rank of a brigadier general. You probably have as good a feel as anybody in Congress today about the condition of the United States military. I was talking with the acting chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee a moment ago, Senator Jim Inhofe, about some of his concerns. Tell me about yours, specifically in the readiness domain. How serious a problem are your comrades in arms in the Army and the other services doing in that regard?
Yes, it's a great question. And you know, I'll make it real simple for you. As a guy who's been privileged to sit at the controls of multiple military aircraft, you just need to know that aviation-related accidents across the force are now double what they were 10 years ago, and that should concern every single one of us. And I'm not talking about combat injuries or deaths. I'm talking about training injuries and deaths and mishaps. And, you know, that can easily be correlated to that's a readiness function, and easily correlated to not only funding for parts and maintenance equipment, but to training and training availability, where service members who fly the aircraft and service members, regardless of what their vocation is in the service, are getting much, much less of the time doing what they're supposed to be training to do. And when you do less of it, you become less proficient and you have accidents. And there's a huge cost to that. And of course, the greater cost, Frank, is that if we had to use those skills in the face of a trained and well-equipped enemy, we wouldn't be to the standards that we require our forces to be. And it's not their fault. This is the job for the Congress. This is the job of the administration. But there's something else that I think you'll find interesting, and I think it's worthy of discussion, which is the infiltration. And I'm going to use that terminology from the last administration and administrations prior into things like the Department of Defense and other long held institutions with high standing and revered among the American people, of individuals that see things very differently from a strategic and tactical standpoint. And let me just bring it home for you. So while we think we should be training to dispatch with the enemy as quickly as possible and get back home, we've got administrators and top level, if you will, in the military, generals and service members that are administering things like, we're doing climate change. You know, we've got DOD studying and taking action on climate change.
To say nothing of social engineering.
It's the social engineering that occurs. And look, every dime that's spent and every minute that's spent doing something other than your primary focus as a service member, as a future combatant, is time away that cannot be wasted. And the American people don't have the money for it, and we don't have the time for it.
Yeah. And again, as you understand so well, Congressman Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, this is a function of mission performance. If you are not able in the end to do the job, not only are you not going to succeed at your mission, you may well not survive undertaking it. This is really a critical point. Let me ask you, if I may, about Mike Pompeo. You served with Mike, of course, in the United States Congress. It looks now as though he will make it through, thank God, the United States Senate to be our next Secretary of State. One of the raps on him is that he's too much of a hardliner, Congressman, and also that he's been critical of not all Muslims, and I've talked with him many times, including on this show. I have found him to be very thoughtful about the problem, but he is, I think, like you, been concerned properly about this phenomenon, this ideology, as the president has called it, I think of it as Sharia supremacism. From your vantage point, both as a man in uniform and as an oversight subcommittee chairman, is there a problem with organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood in our own country that people like Mike Pompeo should be, and for that matter, you should be properly concerned about?
That's exactly right, Frank. And Mike Pompeo is an excellent choice. He's an excellent choice among other reasons because he does see the threat very clearly for what it is. And there is a problem in our country. And of course, partially it's born out of the free nature of our society, where some of these groups that don't necessarily have the best interest of the United States and our way of life.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah, that's not what they support. So the fact that Mr. Pompeo, who's an excellent choice, by the way, all around excellent choice, is being seen as maybe too hard line on some of these things, I think speaks to the fact that over time, America in particular and the world in general has been lulled to sleep or lulled to complacency on the danger of this ideology. It is a radical ideology. And while there are many peace-loving Muslims in America and around the world, the Muslim Brotherhood does not account for one of them, in my opinion.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. Well, we're hopeful that one of the things that will be attended to in his new capacity is the problem of that organization. Let me ask you finally, if I could, Congressman Scott Perry, I know you have been vexed, as have many of us, by this scandal. And I don't think that's too strong a term for it. This scandal involving dozens of your colleagues on the Democratic side of the aisle who have been relying upon Pakistani expats and apparently others involved with what seems to me to be a foreign intelligence service gaining access to, in fact, administering computers in the House of Representatives. What light can you shed on this so-called House IT scandal at this point, Congressman?
Well, as far as I know, and of course, as you kind of allude to, the facts have been, it's been like pulling teeth to get any information about this. And there have been several members, Representative Gohmert and Representative DeSantis in particular, that have not given up their quest to find this information and bring it out to the American people. We are currently awaiting a hearing, so to speak, or at least a meeting with the investigative agencies, and that would be the FBI in particular, with the appropriate committees and subcommittees in Congress on the status of that investigation. It has been years now in the making, and we feel like the ties are long and deep, but we also know that there have been individuals that were involved that have never been interviewed by the investigative agencies, even to this point. And so we are very, very concerned that that is the circumstance and that there could be a potential breach of certainly sensitive information to foreign intelligence services or the compromise of individuals wittingly or unwittingly in Congress based on this IT scandal and the relationships with Pakistan and the people that were involved.
One of what they call in the intelligence business a clue is when these guys are operating servers that have access to the House of Representatives machines from Pakistan. I mean, that sounds to me like a serious indicator that you've got the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, at least on the wire, if not running the operation. Congressman Scott Perry, there's so much more to talk about. I hope that we'll have a chance to do so with you in the near future. In the meantime, thank you for your continuing service to our country in uniform as well as in the Congress of the United States. You are one of our real leaders and most appreciated in that regard. Come back to us again soon, sir. Next up, Kevin Freeman with an update on economic warfare right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined by Kevin Freeman, the man we turn to each week for perspectives on a very important subset of the larger war for the free world, namely the one that's being fought not kinetically, as they say, using old-fashioned military techniques, but economically, through a variety of financial and industrial and informational and other economic methods. One example of which, it seems, at the moment, is involving Turkey. And Kevin, who has been reporting on these matters faithfully at his globaleconomicwarfare.com blog and now at his new television service called The Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, and also addressing all these issues, of course, in various ways in his two terrific and best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. He's in the house to walk us through what the Turks have just done, Kevin, and what it might portend. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the latest developments with the Turks. We've just published, as you know, a new book on how they are, as we call it, allies no more. But what have they done in the economic warfare space that should be giving us pause as well?
Well, the announcement is that they contacted the Federal Reserve and they said, you're holding 220 tons or something of our gold, and we'd like you to send it to us. And that's just not a normal thing that happens. It happens occasionally that nations want to pull their gold out, but it's got some ominous implications.
It probably would come as a surprise to many Americans that we would be holding 220 tons of Turkish gold. Do you know how that came to pass and how long ago? And why would the Turks be saying they want it out of our Federal Reserve?
Yeah, well, after World War II, there was an agreement among the nations that it would be a good idea to keep gold reserves in a central depository. It made it more convenient for when currencies were backed by gold, made it more convenient for trade and so forth. It also established credibility. It's much the same. You may have a pile of money in your house, but when you put it in the bank, the world recognizes it. And it was also a means of keeping peace in the world. You're loath to attack a nation that is holding your gold, and you're less likely to attack your neighbor if your gold is being held somewhere where the world community could have control of it. So it was designed after World War II and as part of the global finance system to bring stability and to bring peace.
And I guess you could say that it's worked reasonably well, along with some other things like effective nuclear deterrence. But the Turks have, as I've indicated, and again, folks, you can see our new book for free at securefreedom.org. It's entitled Ally No More, and it talks about the neo-Ottoman caliphate that Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, seems to be founding. Kevin, they want their gold back, presumably because they think there may be penalties attached to some of their behavior going forward. And they don't want to be subject to them?
Well, there are three reasons they might want their gold back. One is they're having a financial crisis and they've got to pay off a creditor, and so they want their gold back for that purpose. But that doesn't really fit, because if you're having a true financial crisis, generally you turn to the IMF, you turn to the World Bank, and they would say, well, you've got gold on reserves, and they could loan against it or whatever. So that's a possibility. The second possibility is that they're joining Russia and China in this attack on the dollar that we've talked about so much, that they've seen the fissure between the West and Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and so forth, and they're siding with them, thinking that the dollar is not going to be the primary reserve currency. And that's what Russian press reports and Chinese press reports have interpreted this move as saying. And the third one is even more ominous. The third one is that they're preparing for war, and they want to remove any ability for us to touch their assets in case of a serious, serious conflict.
Yeah. And by the way, the Turks have of late been threatening Greece, as I recall, with attacks as another and frankly far more reliable NATO ally these days than are the Turks. Kevin, this is a very worrying thing, that two out of the three explanations are, as you say, pretty ominous. But again, it does seem to fit the facts as they seem to be emerging now, namely that we are facing an increasingly hostile and aggressively hostile Turkey. Let me turn to China. You mentioned their efforts to undermine the dollar and presumably seek to replace it with their own renminbi as the reserve currency of the world, at least in due course. There was a piece that caught my eye in the Epoch Times. It's a newspaper that's published by the dissidents in China, the Falun Gong. They have talked about an industrial warfare campaign. It's a kind of a new term to me, but it makes a lot of sense. saying that that's what China has been waging against the United States for some time. Would you talk about that and how this correlates with some of the concerns Donald Trump expressed both during the campaign and thus far in his presidency?
Well, industrial warfare is a subset of economic warfare. It's a means of using their industrial capacity, and suppliers and everything in the supply chain becomes a point at which you can attack, you can manipulate, you can control. And this is a function of having a centrally planned economy, which they do, control of the major industries that they have. And they view everything as, you know, I've said this before, what we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. So they view all of this as a means of advancing their agenda, and they've been quite effective at it. They've done it through industrial espionage, where they're stealing trade secrets, they're stealing our intellectual property. They've done it through tariffs. They've done it through, you know, it is one very targeted, planned, purposed effort. And it looks to us, well, it's just economic activity. But when people lose their jobs, when we lose our companies and our intellectual property, when we have this massive $376 billion trade deficit with the Chinese, you can step back and you see the big picture. It is centrally planned.
Yeah. As the Epoch Times put it, it's all about seizing the economy of your opponents. And that certainly seems, between the theft of intellectual property, as you say, and the wholesale expropriation of manufacturing capabilities from this country, that's afoot, and we ignore it at our peril. Fortunately, you helping us not to ignore it, Kevin Freeman, both by your contributions to this program and through the work you're doing at globaleconomicwarfare.com and Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Finally, let me ask you about another piece that caught my eye, Kevin Freeman. I think yours too. Namely, it's a report to the effect, I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal, that North Korea's hackers have become dangerously good. Tell us how good and how they've become so dangerous.
Well, the Wall Street Journal points out what I think the intelligence community knew several years ago, when the intelligence community said the attack on Sony Pictures was from North Korea. Most of the cyber community said, oh, they're just not that good. Well, the fact is, they are that good, and they've been increasing in skill and ability, so that the Wall Street Journal points out, over the last 18 months, the nation's fingerprints have appeared in an increasing number of cyber attacks. They're increasing the frequency and the quality. These are not poor quality cyber attacks, ranging from ransomware efforts to just shutting down things. So, you know, even as we have the hopeful signs that maybe, possibly for the first time in a long time, the North Koreans may be honest and dealing with reducing their nuclear capabilities. We don't know that, but, you know, that's been hinted at. At that very same time, they've been ramping up their cyber capabilities.
Yeah. You know, I'm not holding my breath on that honesty bit, but we will be watching it closely, Kevin Freeman. But one of the points that was made in this journal piece was that they're exhibiting more originality. And I would just ask you, and I don't know if any of us can say for sure, Kevin Freeman, but I understand that at least some of these cyber operations on the North Koreans' part are being run out of China. What are the chances that we're simply watching Chinese hackers with great skills and a lot of originality simply doing business as though they were North Korean hackers?
It fits the model perfectly. It's, you know, the Russians have used the Iran at times, and there's no doubt in my mind that any capabilities the North Koreans have developed have come with the assistance of the Chinese, and may be directly Chinese doing it.
So much more to talk about. Kevin Freeman, we look forward to doing so with you again next week. In the meantime, we are extremely impressed by and excited about your new project, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Check it out, as well as Secret Weapon and Game Plan, his two best-selling books. Kevin, we'll talk with you soon. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.